Chapter 8, A Terrible Night. It was a lovely afternoon in the end of August, rather more than a week after the events just related. In a beautiful French valley, through the middle of which ran a clear, sparkling river, its steep sides clothed with forest, four children were just sitting down to rest beneath the spreading branches of a sycamore tree. It was a very pretty scene, and rest was very pleasant to the four de St. Croix, who had already come 8 miles that day, and had to accomplish some four more before they should encamp for the night. They had grown very fond of their gypsy life, now that they were accustomed to roughing it, and except perhaps Louis, who looked rather white and fragile, were all as strong and well as possible and able to accomplish their 12 miles a day without difficulty, even though Henry and Gallum generally carried Louis by turns during the last two or three. The two older boys were decidedly sunburned, and Marie's color was a little deeper than in the days of her grandeur, but her large hat had kept her complexion pretty fair. Today was Gallum's birthday, a very different birthday from any they had hitherto kept. Marie had thought about it all the preceding day, but when the morning came and she and Henry had met him with flattering congratulations, he had turned away, and they had not spoken of it again. They were now talking of the prospects of their journey. The money was holding out pretty well. There were still 8 gold pieces untouched, and Marie carried 12 francs in silver. There would have been more, but that 2 nights, besides the one they spent at Saint-Germain, had been too wet to sleep out of doors, and they had had to pay for lodging. However, Henry calculated that they had accomplished quite a third of their journey to the coast without spending a third of their money, and was rather inclined to forget that the French coast was not their journey's end. "Well, I suppose we ought to be going," he said at length, getting up with a little sigh of regret. "It is so still and pleasant here," said Marie. "Listen, do you hear the wood-pigeons across the valley? How pleasant it is to be in a pretty country again, after those dreary vineyards that we have been passing through lately." "Yes, it makes a great difference," replied her brother. "But I am afraid we must not stay here any longer now, and from what we heard it must be some way yet to Yonneville, and our path further on, you may see, runs right into the belt of forest."
"Louis is asleep," remarked Gallum. "Asleep!" exclaimed Henry. "Why, it is scarcely 3 hours since dinner. He looks very tired, though, poor little fellow," he added, regarding the child wistfully.
"I'm afraid he ought not to walk so much," sighed Marie, "and yet I don't see how we can help it. Our money won't last unless we make at least 12 miles a day, and Louis is scarcely 6 years old.
"He need not walk any more tonight, at any rate," said Gallum. "I can carry him, and if you would slip your arm under him so, Marie, and help me to raise him, I think I can take him up without waking him."
Louis's sleep was too sound to be disturbed by their gentle movements, and they walked on at as brisk a pace as Gallum's burden would allow. About a mile further on, they entered the forest, and found some difficulty in keeping the slightly traced path. Louis was transferred to Henry, and waking suddenly was frightened at the silence and the gathering darkness of the forest. For some time the other three were entirely occupied in trying to soothe him and divert his thoughts, and no one thought again about the path till Henry, choosing a moment when Gallum was intent on Louis, whispered to Marie, "Marie, I am afraid we are going wrong. I am almost sure that we have got into a dry watercourse instead of the path." Marie gazed at him with a face of blank dismay, and, but for his instant sign of caution, might have broken out into exclamations which would have alarmed Louis still more.
"What shall we do?" she whispered at length. I scarcely know, was his answer. Go on, I suppose. I don't think we have altered our course since we came into the wood, and Yonneville lies nearly straight ahead as far as I can make out. It may prove that we have only taken a shorter and rougher way, and at any rate I think we should only get more hopelessly lost if we tried to find the path now it is so dark. Don't you think so? He added, seeing that Gloom had listened to his last speech. Gloom nodded briefly and went on talking to Lewis. For some time they pressed on in the darkness, stumbling frequently and silent with a growing sense of loneliness and fear. The wood grew thicker than ever, and at last every vestige of a path vanished, and they had to thread their way between the trees as best they could. Suddenly Henry, who walked first, came to a standstill, exclaiming, "Hark! Did you hear that?"
"I heard something," said Marie eagerly.
"Listen! What can it be?"
"Hush, Lewis, darling."
For Lewis, thoroughly tired out and startled from an uneasy doze on Henry's shoulder, was beginning to cry. Marie's caress silenced him, and they all stood for a few moments listening breathlessly. Again they heard the sound, and this time quite plainly. It was the sound of a psalm sung by many voices at some distance in front. A cry of relief broke from the three elder children. Though they had never attended such services with their father and mother, they had once before in the course of their journey come upon a night service held by the Huguenots, and they knew what the sound meant. "Come on, Marie," cried Henry, springing forward, as if Lewis had been but a feather's weight. "We are all right now." Making their way through the forest in a somewhat breakneck fashion, they in a short time came so near that the words of the psalm were distinctly audible. It was one they knew well, and with one consent they joined in the grand old song, and so singing they came out upon the open space where the assembly was being held. "Our gracious God has laid his firm foundations on Zion's mount, the courts of his delight. Her gates of splendor bathed in heavenly light, he loves far more than Jacob's habitations. What glorious things, O city of God's favor, are spoken in melodious tones of thee. Rahab will I include and Babel too, with those who know me as their Lord and Savior." But truly, they came out upon a scene which they never afterwards forgot. The clearing was more than 2 acres in extent, and was one dark, swaying mass of human beings. From nearly 1,000 voices the sound went up of that great solemn psalm as from one man. "The Moor with the Philistine and the Tyrian shall soon, O Zion, throng your holy gate. In songs of joy I'll hear her sons relate. These all were born within the walls of Zion. God will himself confirm it with his blessing, and on the roll of nations he will count all these as born on Zion's holy mount, in many tongues, one God, one faith confessing. Then shall God's name with holy adoration and joyful tones be praised by Israel's throng. Both harp and voice will blend in swelling song. In Zion are the founts of my salvation." The dim light of a young moon only threw out in stronger relief the black background of the forest against the paler sky. Then, with a tremendous echoing amen, the song ceased. The great heaving mass swayed, as if shaken by a wind, and fell down. 1,000 heads were bowed in a breathless hush waiting for prayer. On a natural rock pulpit, in the midst of this great forest temple, knelt a single man. Even in the dim light they could see his upturned face, radiant with the light of a great inspiration. After a moment's pause he began to pray, and in that intense living silence his every word fell clearly on the ears of the assembly.
He lifted up his arms to pray to heaven and poured out all his fervent soul in an appeal to God. He prayed for the country, torn and distracted with a thousand dissensions. He prayed for the church, the remnant of the faithful, driven out and despised of men. He prayed for the king, that he might be pardoned in this thing, and might be brought to a better mind. He prayed for all those in sorrow, or in danger, or in temptation at that moment, that they might be saved, comforted, and strengthened in the right way. He prayed for all those kneeling there, that they might be faithful unto death, and die in the true faith of our Lord Jesus Christ. It was a long prayer, and when he ceased, the congregation rose with a rustle as of the leaves on a thousand trees. But the preacher remained kneeling for some moments, and with his face hidden in his hands. At length he rose and stood, still silent, before the people, his arms hanging straight by his sides. "How long, O Lord, how long?" The words rang out suddenly like a cry of anguish on the still night air. "How long, O Lord, shall thy people be trodden underfoot and driven like sheep? How long shall thine altars be desecrated with a mockery of worship? How long shall the whole creation groan with travail for thy coming, O Lord most holy? O God most mighty, O Lord God, just ruler of heaven and earth." True outburst of a true heart, the flood of his eloquence swept on, and his hearers stood entranced. For more than an hour he spoke to them, pleading, exhorting, threatening, and dilating on the love of God and the need of patient continuance in well-doing. At length his arms fell again, and he made a pause, a long dead pause. No one moved. And when he spoke again, his voice grew deep and almost harsh with feeling. "I have spoken to you tonight of the many evils under which we of the true church groan. I have exhorted you generally to patience, to steadfast faith, to courage in the cause of God. But I have somewhat still to say to you. I will speak now of one particular evil, under which not one but many of you who now listen to me are groaning in impotent despair. I will speak now of one particular thing which waits for you to do, of one particular effort of faith and courage in the cause of God which you must make tonight. These are things which must be borne. There are afflictions which it is the part of a good Christian to endure. We have been driven out from our churches. We have been forced to fly from our homes and to live as the son of man who had not where to lay his head. We have seen our dear ones butchered before our eyes for daring to worship God in the simple and pure faith that his son taught. We have been plundered, stripped, beaten. All this and more, even unto death, it is fit that we should bear. But there is one thing that we should not bear, that it is a shame and a disgrace that we should bear. I speak as to wise men. Judge ye what I say. They have taken our children, the souls that God gave us, to rear for his glory, and they think to bring them up in the old darkness, alien from a merciful God, conceiving hard things of him who is our Father, hating instead of honoring the father and mother whom he has given them on earth. Is this a thing to be borne? Shall we, who have been brought by God's mercy to a knowledge of his true light, and who have purged out the falsehood from among us, shall we sit with folded hands while these things are being done? I will speak yet more plainly. Is there one of you here tonight who does not know that within a mile of our town of Cahusac, within scarce half a mile of the spot whereon we stand, 33 of our children, torn within the last 3 months from the bosoms of their mothers, and immured in walls both material and spiritual, are learning to love that which is an abomination unto the Lord, learning to hate the light and truth which it is our part to teach them? I tell you, fathers and mothers, that of you shall these 33 orphan souls be required. I tell you, you who by God's grace are safe in his fold, that of you shall be required these 33 perishing souls. I tell you, O my brethren, that of every one of you, yea, and of me also, will it be demanded in the last day, in the day of judgment, to give account of those 33 souls. He paused again, and the dark mass surged once more, and a low murmur arose like the storm swell far off. But his arms were still outstretched. He had not yet finished. This, brethren, we must do, and that quickly. This very night must this thing be accomplished, and I will tell you how it must be accomplished. There must be no violence, no plunder. Not a hair of the head of these women must be harmed. All must be done decently and in order. We must do this thing, and we must do it as Christian men, working in a just cause. So only, my brethren, shall this thing be acceptable unto the Lord. His arms dropped. And as if the tongues of all that crowd were suddenly loosed, a great clamor of confused cries shook the air, among which the only distinguishable words were, "Rescue, rescue, to the convent, the convent." Then he once more solemnly stretched out his arms to heaven, and the storm of sound sank and fell before him in a breathless silence. The dim light shone upon his face, and he spoke again with a voice that thrilled to the heart of the remotest listener. It is spoken, I charge you all that hear me, to follow me in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. As he ended, he leaped down and pressed on through the crowd, which turned with one impulse to follow him, bursting with one accord into a stirring battle psalm as they hurried on. When God but speaks his mighty word, great is the host whose shouts are heard. The kings have fled like cattle, the women who at home abide. Yes, even they the spoil divide, gained by their men in battle. See here the wealth which they did bring, now silver decks a pigeon's wings, and glistening gold its feathers. Before the Lord the kings all fled, as snow is on Mount Zalmon spread by blasts of stormy weather. When the four children had first come upon the ground, many of the outsiders who saw that they were strangers had with ready courtesy moved aside to let them pass on, so that by the time the service ended they were in the thick of the crowd, and were obliged to follow its movements even had they not wished it. It was very difficult for them, and especially for Gloom, who had now charge of Lewis, to keep up with the swift marching pace of the congregation. But in the darkness they had no choice but to stumble on breathlessly, sheer desperation alone enabling them to do so. Marie felt as if she were moving on in an endless dream. The swift movement through the interminable of forest trees, the darkness, the tramp of a thousand feet around her, and the singing of a thousand voices in that echoing psalm seemed almost too bewildering to be real. She could only cling tremblingly to Henry's hand and follow with the rest as fast as her feet could carry her. Once Henry paused for one moment to take Lewis from his brother, and even in that moment the pressure was so great that Marie fell, and Gloom dragged her up and on almost by main force. After what seemed hours to Marie, but was really not half an hour, the forest thinned and fell away, and they passed into a small open valley. Here there was no sign of human habitation, except one great block of buildings standing near the opposite edge of the forest, evidently the convent which was their object. Still singing the psalm, which they had only finished to begin again, the great human wave swept across the half-reaped field and surged round the high dark walls. One or two lights flitted hastily from one part of the building to another, but there was no sound at their approach. With mighty chariotry untold, his host 10,000-fold, the Lord came to his nation. From Sinai's mount he made his way to Zion, which he made for his holy habitation. Thou didst, O Lord, ascend again with many captives in thy train, and gifts from men obtaining, and from even those who did rebel, that here the Lord our God may dwell, here evermore remaining. The psalm of the besiegers ended, and Marie found herself pressed back again with her brother by the crowd, who were evidently being arrayed in something like order, a short distance from the walls by the preacher, whose voice they could hear above all the rest, though they could not yet distinguish what he said. At length he managed to restore silence, and they made out that he, in company with one or two more, advanced to the great door of the convent, and knocked and rang in due form. After a time a grated aperture in the door was opened, and a face appeared at the sight of which even the murmur of the crowd was silenced utterly, and that all might hear what she had to say. Even then her speech was inaudible to those who were not in the front rank, but the preacher's voice rang out clearly in answer, "We wish to speak with the Lady Abbess, to demand from her the immediate surrender of the 33 children of the Reformed religion unlawfully retained within these walls." An answer was returned almost immediately, to the effect that the Lady Abbess gave audience to no person at that hour of the night, and must request the gentleman who spoke immediately to withdraw with his fellow followers. An angry clamor arose from the expectant crowd, silenced at once by a gesture from the preacher. "Tell the Lady Abbess," he answered boldly, "that we regret to cause her any inconvenience, but that we refuse to leave this spot until our children are delivered up to us." With little delay they received for answer that the Abbess knew nothing of any children of the Reformed religion, that there were some children in the convent, but that, by the blessing of Our Lady, they were all good Catholics. A storm of execration burst from the crowd when they understood this answer beyond the power of the preacher to silence. Threats, groans, and shouts for the Lady Abbess continued without intermission, till Marie wondered when it would end. She found a comfortable and safe resting place in the arm of a splendid tree for Louis, and stood by his side ready to take him in her arms again, should there prove the least occasion. Henry and Galoom grew tremendously excited, though they still remained by their sister instead of pressing to the front. The outcry grew frightful, and some of the rougher of the mob even began to throw stones at the windows, giving unmistakable hints that they would not be restrained much longer. At this juncture, word was passed along the crowd that the Abbess was coming to the balcony to speak with them, and the riotous members were brought back to order. In a few moments a long narrow window which led on to a small stone balcony just above the great door was opened, and a tall stately figure appeared quite alone. A few of the foremost in rank had contrived to possess themselves of torches of some sort, and in the red fitful light she was plainly seen. Her dress was long, white, and flowing. A peculiar black headdress passed around her face, and descended some way upon her shoulders. Her face was not clearly visible, but the clear, firm tones which rang out through the silence which followed her appearance showed plainly what sort of expression it wore. "I am told, messieurs, that you desire to speak with me. You come in a strange manner, and at a strange time, yet I am ready to hear what you have to say, and to request you to prefer your business with speed." She was answered by tumultuous cries of, "The children! The children! Give us back the children!" As soon as the noise subsided, she answered coldly, "I can hold no parley with a confused rabble. If there be a leader among you," and the contemptuous accent was not lost upon the crowd, "let him stand forth and answer me with the best grace and fewest words at his command." Preacher at once advanced in front of his followers, and bowing with extreme courtesy to the proud figure above him, made answer at once, "Madame, we come to demand the instant surrender of 33 children of the Reformed religion, received by you from the king's officers during the last 3 months, and now within these walls." There was a moment's pause, and then the clear tones answered with the same proud scorn, "You do well and bravely, messieurs, to come thus at dead of night and think to frighten a handful of women into compliance with your unlawful and insolent demands. The children of whom you speak are well and happy, and they are fast throwing off the poisonous influence which blighted their young lives, and desire nothing less than a return to their errors. And I, who have saved them from the worse than death, from the very jaws of Satan, think you that I will yield them back again? I tell you that rather will every one of us die this night, and thus present ourselves unstained before our Maker, with the souls in which we have won for him." Again there was a pause, and an undecided murmur among the crowd, on which the accusations of cowardice in their mode of proceeding had made a momentary impression. At that moment the window behind the tall, motionless figure on the balcony was pushed violently open, and in an instant a slight girlish figure in white, with a cloud of wild hair streaming behind her, stood on the extreme edge of the stone parapet. There was a sudden awe-struck hush at the sight of this apparition, and then a shrill, childish voice penetrated even to the outskirts of the crowd. "It is a lie that she has told you. We are all true, even unto death. If ye be men, if ye be indeed followers of the true religion, save us now, before it is too late." She got no further, for strong hands were laid upon her from behind, and she was borne struggling back into the convent. But she had done her work. With one tremendous shout, "God to the rescue," the whole mass of the people flung itself, like one great wave, upon the convent walls. The sudden movement left the St. Croix children alone, some way behind the hindmost of the besiegers. "Oh, Marie," cried Henry and Galoom in one breath, "it is impossible to stay. Are you not safe here with Louis?" "Go, in God's name," answered Marie simply, but with a noble flash in her dark eyes, "I will pray for you." Two boys needed no second bidding before dashing into the thickest of the crowd. Marie, bending to see if Louis were frightened, discovered that in the midst of all the uproar he had fallen fast asleep. She thought with compassion how very tired he must be, and wrapping closer around him the blanket which they had carried all through their journey, she stood waiting for the end of this terrible night. The shouts and cries seemed to increase every moment. Some of the crowd had been detached so as to surround the building, yet in many places there was only a thin line of guard, but all were hammered at the door and windows, even with an insane frenzy at the very walls. Marie tried to pray, but her brains seemed spellbound. She could only gaze with a species of fascination at the scene before her. Suddenly, a still louder cry of mingled horror and exultation rose from the crowd, and looking toward the spot, she beheld flames rising from behind the lower part of the wall. A lighted torch flung frantically over the wall by someone more reckless than the rest had fallen upon the roof of some small outbuildings, and the light wind caused the flames to gain ground with fearful rapidity. Up to this moment the inmates of the convent had remained perfectly silent and invisible since the retreat of the abbess, but now wild shrieks were heard as the fire became plainly visible and seemed to envelop almost all the lower stories of the convent. The besiegers called loudly to the women to come out and battered at the great door more furiously than ever, maddened by the shouts of the women among the crowd, who cried out that the children would perish in the flames while they knocked idly at the door. It was a terrible sight, the great dark forest hemming in the scene on every side, the dark surging mass of human beings that beat like water against those black immovable walls, which rose high above them, girt about the middle with a wreath of spreading flames.
How those flames danced and writhed like fiery serpents, throwing a red lurid light over everything, ringing a crimson blush even over the face of the still starlit heaven. And Marie stood apart, with one arm supporting her sleeping brother on the old tree stump, her face white and still, her beautiful eyes flashing, her body motionless, but her whole heart throbbing with one wild, inarticulate prayer to God. Suddenly, as she gazed, a long, narrow window near the roof of the convent above the flames was flung open, and there it stood, it seemed, upon the sill, the same apparition they had seen before, the slender white figure, and with the cloud of streaming hair thrown out into a strong relief by the Lord's sea of flame beneath. A cry broke from the crowd at the sight of her, but she waved her hand, and great silence fell upon them. "Get up to the little balcony," cried the shrill young voice, making itself heard above the roar and crackle of the flames. "I cannot come down, but all the rest are together in that room. You will save them if you do not lose a moment." "Come down," shouted up the thousand voices to her as one man. "Come down, or you are lost." "I cannot," she answered. "Bear me witness that I died in the faith of my race and made an end worthy of my fathers. For Christ's sake, hasten, or they will all be lost." Even as she spoke, the window below was opened, and a crowd of nuns rushed out upon the balcony. But the abbess was in front of them, and standing on the very spot from which she had dragged back the girl, turned round and confronted the frightened, trembling women. "Back, back," they heard her cry. "Cowards, have ye not vowed to die a martyr's death?" At this moment one of the nuns stooped and threw a rope over the edge of the balcony. The abbess saw it and tried in vain to prevent it, but they were too quick for her, and eager hands below caught and held it fast. Take her away," cried the nuns. "The children are all here, and we would let them down, but she will let no one pass." Before the words were finished, a young agile fellow of 20, much above the ordinary height of Frenchmen, climbed up the rope and stood by the side of the abbess. "Permit me, madame," he said, and the next instant he had taken up the tall, dignified woman as easily as if she had been a child and dropped her over the parapet so that she was obliged to slide down the rope. The rest would have followed instantly, but the young man waved them back. "Bring out the children," he said sternly, and one by one the poor, frightened little things, many of them had nothing on but their night clothes, were passed through from the room within and went safely down the rope to be cried over and blessed and welcomed by the crowd below. "Are the 33 here?" shouted the young man at the last, as the last was lowered. "All safe," was the answer. "Pass then, mademoiselle," he said, offering his hand to the foremost nun, who was not slow to avail herself of the permission. As the man, last of all, slid down the rope, a long, wild cry from above turned all eyes upward again to that slender white figure, and standing now with red flames almost at her feet, and a background of starlit sky seen through the window, for part of the back wall had already fallen in. At the sound, the abbess, who had still been standing aside, mute and motionless, looked up and saw the girl. "Holy Mother," she exclaimed in horror, "let me go back that I may die with her." She actually attempted to ascend the rope in order to re-enter the burning room, but strong hands held her back, and the voices in the crowd cried out, "Look, look, she is gone." The figure above had disappeared. Every face of the thousand was upturned, and for several minutes there was an awful, intense silence. And then, with a roar and a crash, which shook the very ground beneath her feet, the whole of the top of the building fell in. Louis woke with a scream of fright. "Galoom, galoom," he cried, but Marie could not cry for Henry. Her tongue clove to the roof of her mouth. Instinctively, she caressed Louis, while her eyes, dilated with horror, were fastened upon the dreadful scene, looking only for that which she did not see. Some trace of her brothers. The awestruck crowd silently withdrew from those crushed and burning ruins, bearing more than one who had been struck by the falling stones. The nuns formed in a small procession and took their way toward the distant town, singing a Dare. The gray light of dawn began to steal over the ghastly scene. Full 20 minutes must have passed, and still Marie stood motionless, with one arm round her little brother and wild fixed eyes. Suddenly, Louis cried out again, "Gloom, gloom!" And this time he was answered by a shout as three figures came running from behind the ruins. And Marie fell on her knees in wordless thankfulness, feeling rather than seeing that her prayer was granted. The next moment she was clasped in Henry's arms, while Louis flung himself recklessly from his perch upon Gloom, and then Marie cried out almost in fear, for in the third figure, clad in white serge, with streaming hair and uncovered head, she recognized the young girl who had seemed to perish before their eyes. "You are safe, then!" she exclaimed in astonishment, as the newcomer threw herself into Marie's arms. "Safe and unhurt, thanks to God and to your brothers," answered the clear, ringing tones which had made themselves heard to such good purpose that night. "But what nobleness! What devotion!"
"You saved her?" asked Marie, turning to her brothers in still greater astonishment. And then, perceiving that Gloom's head was tied round with his handkerchief, she added in terror, "Oh, Gloom, how is this? You are hurt?"
"It is but a trifle," answered Gloom, who was very pale, but as quiet as ever. "Come away, Marie, let us rest out of sight of this." They went into the wood a little way and sat down on the soft, fragrant moss to discuss their adventures.
"I do not quite understand how you came to be in the convent," said Marie to the newcomer after a little while. "There were 33 counted out besides you."
"I was never one of the 33, nor do I belong to the people," replied the young lady, with a slight accent of hauteur. "I am Leonore Isabel Virginie Felicita, Comtesse de Villeneuve, and head of my race."
"But you are of the religion?" asked Marie anxiously.
"I am of the religion of my father, and he was a Protestant. Do you want to know how I came into the convent?"
"Because my father refused to sign the abjuration. They quartered the dragoons upon us. Because we tried to escape, they hunted him and shot him down. Because I was wealthy and no son, they spared my life, and would have married me to my cousin, who is as good a Roman Catholic as he is a bad man, and who is twice as old as I am to boot. Because I rebelled and sang my father's psalms, without looking at the count whenever he came to see me, they confiscated all my property and sent me to the convent."
"Ah, but I led them a life," continued this strange girl, not perceiving that her listeners looked somewhat astonished as she went on. "I flung the Virgin from the altar. I said my own prayers out loud when they were at Mass. I dropped the spider into the holy water when the abbess was going to cross herself. There is no end to the tricks we played upon each other. They took all clothes from me but the habit of a novice, and I unstrung the rosary they gave me and made bracelets out of it. They used to have a fight with me to cut my hair, and I flung it into their eyes, and then jumped on to the windowsill and made as if I would throw myself out when they came near me. Yesterday I was 14, and the abbess had determined that my hair should be left no longer. They came behind me by stealth and pulled my hair all down, but I was too quick for them. Oh, what a chase I gave them all that day," and she shook back the hardly kept hair with laughing pride in the recollection.
"And how did you get free of them at last?" asked Marie with eager interest.
"Oh, I got into the abbess's own cell, while they were chasing me over the convent, and barricaded the door against her," answered the girl with a burst of laughter, and exchanged compliments through the keyhole. "They got tired at last and went away, but they came back again to console me with the amiable announcement that I should not have a morsel of food till I came out and submitted, And just as I was assuring the abbess that I was perfectly ready to starve in her chamber and haunt her every night afterwards, I heard a sort of little scuffle in the convent, and then everybody ran away at once. I thought it was a ruse at first, and I waited till I heard the noise of a great crowd outside. Then I guessed what had happened and stole out very cautiously. I got into the great room without anyone seeing me, and then I made a rush for the window, as you saw. "Yes, you did that well," said Marie admiringly. But what did the abbess do to you?" "Oh, we fought each other all the way up to that little room, and then she managed to push me in and lock the door." "Then how was it you were saved?" asked Marie with a shudder. Leonore's ready flow of words was silenced as she held out her hand to Henry, and the quick tears sprang to her eyes. "I believe he came through the fire," she said in a low tone. "It was Gloom's doing," said Henry briefly. "He found the rope, and he was waiting on the cloister roof to hold it fast as we came down." "What? You slid down a rope outside?" exclaimed Marie in horror. "How could you manage it?" "I shall never know to my dying day how we managed it," asked Eleanor in a tone of deep feeling. "But we came down somehow. See my hands." And Marie had a momentary glimpse of palms scratched and bleeding from the friction of the rope. "And they seized and dragged me to the very end of the cloister roof just in time." "Yes, the convent fell sooner than I thought it would," continued Henry as Leonore broke off and shuddered. "The shock threw us down almost senseless for some minutes, and the stones rattled like great hail all around us. But only a little one hit Gloom, and when, after a while, we looked about us for the best way to get down, we found that the debris made it easier." "Oh, if I had known," gasped Marie, covering her face with her hands. Henry put his arm tenderly around her. "Hush, my Marie," he whispered. "Your prayers helped to save us, and it is all over now." "Yes, it is all over now," exclaimed Leonore, recovering her spirits as suddenly as she had lost them. "Let us be reasonable and consider what is next to be done. You, do you belong to any place about here? I see you are not of the people." "Oh, no," said Marie sadly. "We are noble, but we are orphans and outcasts like you, and are now on our way to Bordeaux, intending to sail from there to Amsterdam." "What a capital idea!" exclaimed Leonore with enthusiasm. "You will let me join your party, won't you? For France is now hateful to me." "Oh, yes, you shall come with us," answered Marie and the two elder boys together, while Louis looked at Leonore with puzzled eyes, as if he did not quite understand the arrangement. Gloom here interposed with a suggestion that they should take some rest, as none of them except Louis had slept that night. The three others scouted the notion of sleepiness, but as they did not wish to proceed just yet to the village, they agreed to rest a while in the same place, and Gloom's eyes twinkled with lazy satisfaction as he saw them gradually fall asleep around him before he followed their example.